The Forest, Chapter 1, The Shed. Taran looked back and squinted through the torrential downpour. Behind him, in the shelter of a small clump of tamarack trees, he could see his twin brother River crouching and nervously watching. Taran slowly turned back around. The dark entrance of the old wooden shed was just one step away, rain drizzling from the doorframe. He looked at River again, then chewed his lower lip and turned to the black, shadowy hole that led into the shed. He stepped forward into darkness. Somewhere behind him, he heard River scream. Today was supposed to be much, much different. Just 3 hours earlier, Taran was curled up in bed, one foot lazily draped over the edge of the mattress, one bright blue eye barely open, and his blonde locks tangled, twisted, and still reeking of chlorine from the previous day's trip to the swimming pool. Still half asleep, he watched his brother River hopping on one leg under the dim nightstand light, pulling on his clean white socks. "Riv, it's so early," Taran struggled to form words as his brain slowly came to life. "It's almost 8, brother. Extreme sports summer camp is at 9. Get dressed." Taran rolled over. The blackout curtains were still pulled tight over the window. For all he knew, it was 4 a.m., and it sure felt like it. Summoning every shred of his lazy morning strength, he extended one tiny index finger and pulled a corner of the curtains aside. No sun. "It's dark!" River stopped fumbling with his shoes and looked up. "Huh?" Taran rolled over and yanked violently on the curtains with one lazy arm, revealing grayish black clouds, a torrential downpour, and a dark, dreary day. River groaned, shoving aside his expectations of a summer day that was supposed to promise swimming, tennis, capture the flag, and everything else that was the extreme magic of sports camp. Now it was just extremely wet. Camp was canceled. It was the rule of rain. For a 10-year-old boy, the presence of a summer storm arouses energy, creativity, daring. As River pulled on his hiking boots and fleece hoodie, he spoke in hushed, choppy sentences. "Taran, mushrooms, hunting, come on." Taran sat up, rubbing his eyes. He knew where River was going. Many twins have a strange built-in neural connection that allows them to actually read each other's minds and even develop secret unknown languages that researchers call cryptophagia. Although the virtual wiring between River and Taran never really resulted in a new language, it did indeed allow them to anticipate each other's thoughts, feelings, and intentions with uncanny lightning speed. And even in his half-asleep state, Taran instantly knew the plan. River wants to go hunting for morel mushrooms in the rain. He's whispering so father and mother don't hear, and he's going to be gone in 5 minutes, whether or not I'm by his side. 5 minutes later, two dark shadows emerged from the front door of their barn house and stepped out into the morning rain. Morel mushrooms have been called by many names. Some of the more colorful varieties are called dryland fish because when you slice them lengthwise, their outline resembles the shape of a fish. And when breaded and cooked in olive oil, you could argue that they may even be better than fried fish. They're also called Merkles or miracles, based on the story of how a mountain family was saved from starvation by eating the spongy mushrooms. In Kentucky, morels are called hickory chickens, and in West Virginia, molly moochers or muggins. River and Taran didn't care what they were called. All they knew was that when you scramble morels with eggs, add some sea salt and black pepper, sprinkle with olive oil, and serve on toasted sourdough bread, you have a breakfast fit for a king. And even for a 10-year-old pair of boys, to hunt morels was not really rocket science. In the forests of the Pacific Northwest, and particularly in the boys' home state of Washington, the easily identifiable morels could be found in nearly any moist, coniferous forest, often sprouting under great pines. The trick was to differentiate the false morels from the true morels by carefully studying the mushroom cap, which is often wrinkled or brainy in the reddish-brown fake morels, as opposed to the honeycomb, net-like appearance of a true yellowish-brown morel. River and Taran also knew, upon closer inspection, the false morels contain a tiny cotton ball-like substance inside their stem, while true morels are hollow inside. The caps of the false morals could easily be twisted in comparison to the true morale. And finally, even though it had never happened to them, the ultimate sign that you'd discovered the wrong kind of morale is that your tasty breakfast would result in severe gastrointestinal upset, loss of muscular coordination, and a wildly erratic heart rate. And so they hunted, but hunted wisely. Their adventures in wild foraging weren't limited to morels. For the past 2 years, ever since father and mother had moved the family out into the forest, River and Taryn had grown to love learning the land, rushing back from hikes in the woods with dirty faces and pockets full of leaves, roots, stems, buds, flowers, and mushrooms. Then they would dart down to the basement to pore through photos in father's field guides. Plant identification was a favorite pastime of theirs. What can you eat? What will kill you? What is medicinal in small quantities but toxic in large quantities? What can fix nosebleeds and cure constipation? What makes tea? What makes smoothies? What lends pop and flavor to a salad? And even more importantly, what goes well with scrambled eggs? What can draw poison from a bee sting? And what can keep mosquitoes and ticks from playing on your skin? Nettles, mint, and yellow violet for salads. Plantain for insect bites. Yarrow for cuts and bruises. Wild strawberry for a snack. Pineapple weed for a tummy ache. And dried mullein to help with sleep. Gooseberry and sarsaparilla root for flavoring soda water. Houndstooth as a diuretic. Pennycress for a fever, Oregon grapefruit and leather leaf for the flu, tansy as an insect repellent, and even thorny prickly spear thistle stalks for chewing like celery when you need a little water. And then, of course, there were the morels, a particular favorite. Even a drizzly summer morning couldn't stop a pre-breakfast morel hunt. Taryn grinned. Jackpot! He bent down to snatch a spongy morel while simultaneously eyeing two more just a couple feet away. His mouth was already watering as he shoved the tiny morsels of goodness into his black mesh plant-gathering bag. Down the hill, about 100 feet, he could see River's wet blonde hair bobbing up and down, his hoodie thrown back as he, too, embraced the rain and searched for breakfast. Taryn's fingers brushed the loose dirt and debris aside from the base of the two other mushrooms. He'd always loved dirt, dust, mud. Earth. Terra. They say there's something to a name, and Taryn was no exception. Despite Mother's ever-impending wet washcloth, he'd always felt more natural and complete, with dirt smudges on his face, black mud under his fingernails, and clods of dirt in his hair. As his fingers sunk into the wet soil, he suddenly stopped. Something wasn't right. There. There it was again. A monotone-like chirp.
Chicka!
Taryn spun and looked up to the tree branches.
Chickadee-dee.
It was definitely a bird. Most definitely a chickadee. Chestnut-backed chickadees were a common sight in this forest, and their sharp chickadee call was unmistakable. Whether maintaining contact with a chickadee mate, scolding a predator, or announcing a food source, it was a usual occurrence to hear a chickadee call over the sing-song chorus of all the other birds. But not in the rain. Never in the rain. Instead, on a stormy morning like this, as the temperature plunges, the tiny birds seek shelter and warmth, conserving their metabolism and avoiding unnecessary activities like grooming and singing. And yet, despite the storm, this tiny bird was twittering ferociously as it called down to the boys in loud, scolding chirps. Taryn had already spotted the little chestnut-colored bird with the tiny black-and-white head as it acrobatically danced from limb to twig, jumping, flitting, and flying overhead through the blend of Douglas firs and ponderosa pines. Yet something was wrong. Out of the corner of his eye, Taryn could see that River had heard the bird too and had stopped in his tracks to straighten bolt upright as soon as the chickadee call sounded over the loud hum of falling raindrops. Taryn pointed up as his eyes met his brother's. River followed Taryn's outstretched finger and nodded. He saw it too. As the chickadee began to dart away through the treetops, they both followed. They knew enough about normal animal activity to realize that some strange game was afoot. Every species of bird has an ancient language, and this bird seemed to be acting as some kind of a messenger, sounding off a greeting? A warning? Some kind of signal? Taryn strode softly through the underbrush, watching the bird overhead. At the same time, using his owl eyes, he could see River still farther down the hill, sneaking parallel to him. Owl eyes had come in handy for Taryn when he needed a big field of vision. He liked to think about an owl perched on a tree branch above the ground, sitting motionless with its eyes in a fixed gaze, and using a still head and wide peripheral vision to gather visual cues from the environment. For a human boy, this technique was simple to learn with practice. To learn how to use his own owl eyes, Taran would sit in a dedicated spot. He'd call it a sit spot. And imagine he had eyes as big and powerful as an owl, eyes that have actually outgrown their eye sockets and are nearly frozen in place, eyes very much unlike a human eye that is constantly engaged in tunnel vision on a screen or on a page in a book. Then he'd look straight ahead and imagine that his eyeballs were stuck in his eye sockets, unable to move. He would pick a spot directly across from him that he could train his eyes on and hold that spot in the center of his vision as a focal point. If his eyes wandered off, he'd try to relax and bring them back to his focal point again, always returning to that one single spot. Eventually, while staring at that spot and without moving his eyeballs, he could see parts of the ground below and parts of the sky above between him and that spot. He'd practice seeing the ground, the sky, and that spot all at the same time using his peripheral vision. And then he'd practice building on this peripheral vision by adding to his awareness the farthest thing he could see to the left and the farthest thing he could see to the right, all still without moving his eyeballs. Once he'd practiced his owl eyes enough, he could see five things all at once without barely any head or eye movement. His focal point, the ground, the sky, the extreme left, and the extreme right. Taran knew that River was using his owl eyes too, and as their chickadee focal point led the brothers deeper into the trees, Taran recalled a story from their wilderness survival camp last summer. He couldn't quite remember the story in vivid detail, but he knew that it involved two hikers walking up a winding road. The hikers didn't know it, but just around the bend, a logging truck was flying wildly down the road after losing its brakes. However, a bird was watching. And just before the truck came careening around the corner, one hiker heard this bird give a shrill, sharp cry, and the hiker instinctively dove from the road, pulling her companion along with her. Novice hunters often experience a similar phenomenon if they traipse too loudly or move too quickly through the underbrush. Often a deer, elk, or bear doesn't notice the hunter coming, but the birds do, and the bird language quickly shifts to warn the other forest animals of impending danger. While Taran had never formally learned bird language, he knew of the general rule that the smaller brown birds that live near the ground tell you the most, whether they're signaling aggression, alarm, begging, companionship, or song. Called perching birds, or passerines, these birds have the most reliable voices and include sparrows, wrens, blackbirds, and of course, chickadees. Woodpeckers, herons, ducks, hawks, and eagles aren't as much good to gather information from. The chickadee was moving at a pretty fast pace, and Taran half-jogged and half-walked to keep up, his brother still trailing parallel to him, just slightly down the sloping hill. After traversing nearly 3 football field lengths through the forest, Taran nervously glanced at River. The bird was still calling and moving, but was also fast approaching the outer boundaries of their family property. This boundary was not easy to miss. Signaled by strips of old, rusted barbed wire, bands of red spray paint on several large pines, and a sudden thickening of the gooseberry and wild blackberry underbrush, it was property that River and Taran had never stepped into for more than a few feet. Over the 2 years they had lived in their home in the forest, they'd always had plenty of acreage to explore. But this adjoining property was not theirs. It was not welcoming. It was not easy to hike. There was no sign of a residence, a driveway, lights, or any other sign of human life. It was not even clear who actually owned it. But by now, the chickadee had quickly progressed nearly 40 feet past the barbed wire and was still moving, stopping, calling, and moving again. Taran heard panting and looked behind him. River was now there. "What do we do now, Riv?" River glanced nervously behind. The rain was falling harder. A chilly wind had picked up and was gliding through the trees. The ground was getting muddier by the minute. "Let's follow." Taran nodded. Both boys instinctively dropped to their stomachs and elbows and crawled under the barbed wire military style. Getting face down in the mud and a front side full of grime was easier than getting your hoodie ripped on a barb. Once past the barbed wire, they stood and began their brisk pace again. The bird was still well ahead of them and still moving fast. Terran moved in front, brushing aside low-hanging branches. River trailed 10 feet behind, knowing better than to follow so close as to get smacked in the face and chest as the thicket snapped back after Terran passed through. Both boys now moved quietly and quickly, occasionally glancing anxiously behind and half expecting to see some kind of ranger or police officer hot on their trespassing trail. With laser-like precision, their feet touched the ground, toe first, then midfoot, then heel. Called fox walking, this silent style of movement allowed them to keep their owl eyes focused up, while their feet worked to sense broken sticks, sharp rocks, logs in the path, and other barriers. Now completely soaked from head to toe, his face, chest, and pants covered in mud, and small cuts on his face from charging through the branches and the sticks, Terran concentrated with ferocious intensity to move through the ever-thickening forest and still catch sight of the small shadow of the chickadee darting from tree to tree. Toe, midfoot, heel. Keep your eyes on the bird. Toe, midfoot, heel. Brush aside the thorns. Toe, midfoot, heel. Glance back to see if brother is still there. Silence. The bird had suddenly stopped. No call. No movement. Terran squinted through the trees. He pulled aside a clump of branches. He could hear River quietly panting behind him. Through the thick rain, he tried to focus in the direction he had last seen the black dot of the bird's movement. He couldn't see any sign of the bird. But there was something else. Some kind of dark, shadowy structure. Too thick to be a tree, and too symmetrical to be a clump of big bushes. It was some kind of a building. Terran moved forward again to a position where the trees no longer blocked so much of his view. Now he could see it more clearly. It was too small to be a home, not a barn. A hunting blind, perhaps? An outhouse? Terran took a few steps forward. Behind him, River sharply whispered, "Terran, let's go!" Terran stepped forward again. "Home, Terran, let's go!" Terran shook his head and, without looking back, took two more big, quiet steps forward. Now he could see the structure clearly, about 50 feet away. It was an old wooden shed. And perched just above the door of the shed was the chickadee, sitting, silent, and staring right back at Terran with two beady black eyes.